This is the Solid Signal podcast for the week of March 4th, 2024. And you know, every so often I like to do one of these podcasts where I rant and rave and I give you a whole bunch of conspiracy theories and stuff like that. These are the podcasts that actually get the most listens. And so I do tend to use them sparingly because they are off topic. It's not really what this podcast is about. But on the other hand, they're a heck of a lot of fun to make. And judging by the number of people who listen, they're a heck of a lot of fun to listen to. And the subject of this week's podcast is open source software. There's a lot to unpack here, and so I'm going to try to keep this as short as I reasonably can, because I feel like I could rant for about an hour on this subject if I really wanted to. First of all, let's talk about the definition of open source software. You may not realize it, but a lot of the internet, most of the web servers out there, pretty much every Android phone, every Chrome device, most of the streaming devices out there are based on something called open source software. You see, it started in about the 1960s when AT&T, which was at the time one of the biggest tech companies in the world, developed a new operating system that was going to hopefully be flexible enough to run the next generation of telephone exchanges. Landline telephone was huge back then. I cannot overestimate the importance of landline telephone service in the 20th century. And where the 20th century started out with operators, real humans, connecting every single call, that clearly became pretty much impossible to handle. And the increases in the need for this sort of thing actually drove a lot of the improvements in technology in the later part of the century. In fact, the transistor, which is the essential building block of every single computer chip, was invented by AT&T scientists for the purpose of helping to automate telephone calls. AT&T developed an operating system called Unix. It was one of the very first what we would call modern operating systems. And one of the things about it was completely modular. It wasn't just written as one big program. It was written as a whole bunch of modules that could be changed anytime you needed to. And this is continued along today with every computer, every device, whatever. When you do an update, you're updating only part of it generally, not the entire operating system. Now, back then, the idea that somebody would pay for an operating system independent of the computer didn't make any sense. Because, after all, computers cost millions of dollars in today's money back then, and the operating system was just something that people, you know, the company threw in because the computer wouldn't run without it. The entire idea of computer languages and computer operating systems being for-profit kind of things came along about 10, 15 years later, but I'm jumping ahead. And I'm trying to make this as fast as I can because we have to get to the meat and potatoes of this podcast pretty quick. Well, almost immediately, because Unix, this operating system, was considered to be so good, people tried to copy it. And AT&T didn't really like that so much, but the courts hadn't really built the laws about whether or not you could copyright an operating system or a computer language yet. And so a bunch of people set out trying to basically copy everything that Unix did in a way that it could be portable, in the way that it didn't have to rely on a particular kind of computer. Great idea. And AT&T did try to assert their legal right, and in fact, there were a whole bunch of really important laws written about this idea that said that if you could engineer something without ever looking at the source code, but you could make it work exactly identical, that was legal. But if anybody in the process, even like a janitor, saw the original source code, that wasn't legal. And that's important because as we get into the 1980s, you had all these competing versions of what was then called Xenix, the open competitor to Unix, was being sold for profit. They were all trying to take a piece of the market. And AT&T, which had kind of spun Unix and its own development off at that point, had really, they had their hands full in trying to enforce copyright. I'm not going to say that they ever really gave up, but it was a series of, again, landmark lawsuits in the late 1980s that established that you could have these independent versions of Unix. You weren't allowed to call them Unix, but you could call them something similar if you wanted to, and that they would work identically to Unix, and anybody could write one. Flash forward into the 1990s, and this graduate student by the name of Linus Torvalds wrote his own version of Unix called Linux, and he made it free for everybody. And he really started turbocharged the idea of an open source software that was free for anybody to use, free for anybody to design. And as long as you obeyed a certain number of very fixed rules as to how you did it, then you could make whatever changes that you want. And in fact, the source code was available to anybody for anybody to change. This change into open source software was a revolution that took about 15 years to really bear fruit. But the idea that you could take this really well-built kind of operating system and, you know, redo it yourself for whatever need you wanted to for free, and all you had to do was pay for the person who was doing the redoing, was just massive. And Apple started doing this with all of their Macintosh computers were running a cousin of Linux, let's put it that way. Android phones were running a cousin of Linux. All of this is based on the Linux code that was out there and the development that was being done. Most of the development that was being done, it was done by people who weren't getting paid, who just thought it was a neat thing to do. And that is really where I'm getting to here. So we're at the point now where, as I said, a majority of the internet runs on Linux or some derivative of it. Pretty much every smartphone, every streaming device, most smart televisions, and in fact, pretty much any consumer appliance that has some sort of connectivity to the internet probably is running a version of Linux. So, by the way, is the DVR in your living room if you have satellite television. So is pretty much anything, honestly. Open source software is everywhere. And that brings us, after almost 8 minutes of this podcast, to the complaint, the concern that I have. So think about it for a second. Almost everything, everywhere, is based on this idea that there's a bunch of people who are maintaining this thing for free. There's very little control over them. There's very little understanding by the average person of exactly who's doing this work. And so far, that hasn't been a huge problem. But I feel like we're on borrowed time. And that is, I've been trying to get to this point for 8 minutes already. That's the point I'm trying to make. A couple of weeks ago, AT&T had an outage due to a software update. Now, no one is saying that this software update that didn't work out properly was due to Linux or open source software or anything like that, but it made me think that it could have been. Because the truth of the matter is, no matter how big of a company or how small, everybody who's depending on Linux is probably depending on a relatively small number of people who have servers in their basement and who are doing a lot of development for free. That's not a bad thing. And yeah, there's some sociological implications of that. And this isn't really a political podcast, so I'm not going to bring that up right now. But the point is that these are the weak links in the chain that run virtually everything in our modern world. If it turns out that there's a bug that was created by one of these people and it did not get found, despite all of the efforts and all of the layers of protections that everybody who develops Linux has and collaborates on, that could bring down everything, literally everything. And it's not just the internet. It's not just cat videos, friends. It is military hardware that runs open source stuff, and maybe not United States military hardware. I don't know. They don't tell you a lot of that stuff, but possibly, maybe it is, and I don't know. And it could be anything. And as we get to the point where we see artificial intelligence beginning to dawn, it brings in a whole new layer of concern. And I don't want to be that guy who is all, oh, AI is going to kill us, AI is going to kill us, because certainly there's enough evidence that it will anyway. But what I do want to say is that at this moment in time, as I'm recording this podcast in 2024, we know two things about AI. The first thing is that it really has trouble telling reality from fantasy. We haven't built that in yet, and we haven't maybe on purpose given AI the ability to understand its environment well enough to be able to tell the difference between reality and fantasy. So, that said, we can't trust AI because we do not know what it thinks is real. And a lot of these AI models are extremely opaque, and we don't even understand how they come up with the answers that they do. And the second thing, perhaps a bit scarier, is that when it comes to AI, people are using AI to write more code. And as we use AI tools more and more to write more and more code, we humans get less and less understanding about what is going on the inside. I'd say most people today, probably 99% of people, do not understand what is going on inside their electronic devices. And imagine if that went to 99.99%, if even that tiny sliver of people who supposedly understood what was going on inside those things didn't. And then something breaks. And then who do you ask? Because you do not know if the AI did it on purpose, and you do not know why the AI did it, because you can't ask it. And you may not be able to ask the AI to fix it because they may not understand what it is that they did wrong. This is what scares me about all AI-generated software development, but especially open source stuff, because when it comes to open source, you know, like I said, there are these really defined points of failure that just kind of scare me, because you do not have a large organization that is working toward the same goal as much as you can. It's very, very decentralized. In the case of something like Wikipedia, that sounds good because everybody can edit things, and in the end, it seems like everybody tends to agree on a certain version of reality that makes sense. But when it comes to the very essential building blocks of the internet and everything that uses it, that may not be the right thing to think about. I'm kind of curious to see what you have to say about this. Do me a favor. I'd love to start the conversation here wherever you get this podcast. Like, subscribe, and leave a comment. I'm interested on finding out if I'm the only person who's really worried about this sort of thing, or if you are too. Also, while I'm mentioning it, do me a favor again and shop at solidsignal.com for everything you need for your best digital life. And if you want the best in customer service, please call 888-233-7563. Go to signalconnect.com. We will take great care of you. That's it for this podcast. Next week, I promise to be back on topic, and I will see you again then.